Welcome. I'm Kerry Carrington, the creator of the podcast series Remembering Randall, my brother. In this podcast, Betty Taylor, widely known and revered for her tireless advocacy on behalf of the survivors of domestic family violence in Queensland, she tells a different story. In 2017, she was commissioned by the then Minister of Health, Cameron Dick, to undertake an investigation and provide a report on the harms experienced by a number of women who, as children and state wards, were admitted against the law to locked adult mental wards at Wollaston Park Mental Hospital. This occurred, well, as far as we know, from the 1950s right through to the 1980s. There were at least 60 such young girls, but there could have been many more. We just don't know because there's never been an inquiry in the 20th century into Wollaston Park. And Betty makes a convincing and compelling case why there should be one. Here's her story. And trigger warnings for listeners that this podcast contains very distressing details about the harms experienced by those women, my brother, chemical restraint, and suicide. Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself, what you do, your background, and how you got involved in writing this report for the government? Just briefly.
Okay. Well, I've worked across domestic violence and sexual assault for about 34, 35 years in all sorts of settings and, you know, direct service delivery and training. But I've also chaired the Domestic Violence Council for all two terms and done a lot of work, I guess, across that high-level systems, sits on the Death Review Board, et cetera. In terms of how I came by this, I was actually out of the blue approached by health to see if I would undertake this piece of work. And I met with Cameron Dick, who was the health minister at the time. And, you know, at the time, actually, I said no because it was way out of anything that I'd ever been involved in. But, you know, they were just sort of talking about, well, like the abuse of women, the sexual abuse of women, et cetera. And he thought that I would bring, you know, some honesty and whatever to it. And I thought, I'm not sure if you knew how honest I might be about all this. So the first instance I said I wouldn't undertake it unless I was acceptable to the women, because when he told me the work had been done to date, there'd been a lot of, I guess, people coming and going out of their lives. They told parts of it. I think people found it too distressing to continue when the women were let down, et cetera. So I said, I need to be acceptable to the women. So send out my resume, whatever you need to do. He came back and said yes. And I started from there, and I think I was given the names of about 10 women to contact, and some I met more than once. So I met all of them in person. Some of them then continued on phone, some of them email, et cetera. And, you know, it was quite a, I guess, you know, I acknowledged them how hard it would be, that they were reliving something that was had been their life for so many years.
Okay, so just so that's your background and that's how you became involved. And then so what were you asked to do? You were asked to interview the women about their experiences in Wollaston Park. So just
there's a group of women that become commonly known as the Goodner Girls that were going to the government around, you know, when the redress schemes were on, that they fell out of both the Ford inquiry.
Yes.
And now with the new redress scheme, they weren't even sure if they'd be eligible for that. But at the same time, they were feeling that they really needed something specific. The abuse against them really was by a government institution.
And what was that government institution? And exactly sort of, can you, for the listeners, can you tell them the background of these women? What age were they when they were put in these adult mental facilities in Wollaston Park?
Okay, so the institution obviously was a Queensland health facility at Wollaston Park, the mental health. But they were placed there also as under the child protection scheme as it was there. They were all children who, they were underage, so they were all teenagers and younger, but they weren't adults. They were placed there involuntary, so none of them were there in a voluntary capacity. They were placed there against their will, and often, I think nearly all of them actually didn't have guardians as such that could speak to them. So,
were they all state wards?
They're all state wards, and most of them had been in, all of them had been in what those days would have been called orphanages, or in back inverted commas, homes. So they were placed into those homes. Some of them were separated from siblings. Often they had coming from a history where there was violence and neglect, but some of them was just abandonment, where their mother, the primary carer, could not care for them. There could have been broken homes, etc. What precipitated them being sent to Wollaston Park was often behaviours that would have been described as, you know, I guess almost some of it was just disobedience or acting out of their circumstances with no consideration to the trauma that they as young people would have been experiencing at the time.
And so you've in your report, you've looked at the various abuses that they underwent and that they experienced. One of them was chemical restraint. Would you like to just elaborate a little bit on what some of the women told you about the chemical restraints that they experienced as children?
Yes, yeah, so they all went to Wollaston Park. There was no facilities, there for them to be kept in a place for underage children. They were often kept with the criminally insane.
Yes.
They were kept with adults, and they experienced sexual, physical, emotional, verbal abuse daily, as told me. And the chemical restraints were, I think, two things. One was to keep them very much controlled, that they would be quietened down if they were given certain drugs. But the other was that they felt that the drugs facilitated the sexual abuse of them. Easier to calm them and to virtually rape them if they were calmed down with drugs.
So the next, so the chemical restraints were partly about controlling them, but partly also about calming them so that they were easy prey for being raped. So how did they describe this to you, like the rapes and the sexual abuse they received in? Was it like a one-off? Was it rare? Was it pretty much systematic? Was it?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't rare at all, and it wasn't one-off. It was continual. And they talked about they were raped by staff and other inmates. It was, and the sexual abuse ranged from people leering at them while I had the showers, stripping off, people watching them while I had the showers, sometimes even delaying, letting them get dressed again, because they were virtually on show to everyone, right through to digital penetration. Often their medical examinations were physical, and they believed them to be also a form of sexual abuse, that it was just a daily occurrence for them. They just felt that there was no escape from that.
Wow. And how old were these? They were ages range between about what, 13 and 15 or?
Probably 13 up to 16, but around that 14, 15. Very young. At least two of them escaped from there to be brought back by the police. And when they left, you know, their lives then were living on the street. You know, they've had a they up until that time when I was talking to them and had a life of continuing suffering. It wasn't just what they endured at Walston Park, but that set them up for their whole life virtually.
I was going to get onto that. Was there anybody in the institution that they could complain to about this?
No, not that they told me. No, they felt that if they started to complain and it got back down to the staff that were abusing them, that things would get worse for them.
Okay.
That they really didn't have a champion within there that was prepared to help them.
And what decades were these? This is the 1960s, 70s, 80s?
I think the oldest one was into the late 50s, 60s, and then into the 70s.
Okay. Late 70s, early 80s, I think, wasn't it?
But I do also need to say, Kerry, like, from what these women have said to me and what they've shown me, their records and things, none of those women were, or young girls that were incarcerated against their will. They were underage wards of the states and they had no champions at all that were there for them.
And they didn't have a mental illness either?
No, no mental illness at all. And the medication that they were on, there's various forms of medication that some of it, you know, they knew was the same medication that they were treating the criminally insane with.
So very powerful psychotic drugs.
Very, very powerful. And none of them, I think, had proof of this, but what they were relaying to me was that they felt they were guinea pigs, vials of drugs being used on them.
And then When they did survive and did escape and tried to rebuild their lives, this trauma lived with them, though, didn't it? It had a huge impact on their lives.
Had a massive impact on their life, on their both physical and mental health, that they talked about being in domestic violence situations. They talked about the ongoing neglect of their own physical health, not wanting to get things like regular pap smears, not wanting to get dental checkups, not wanting to go to hospital for any length of time. They were, as they were getting older, they were really, I think, worried about any institutional care that may come with ageing. They tried to steer clear of any of those institutions as they saw them, had a real fear of the whole health service provision.
Yes. As you would. Yeah, the same thing happened with my brother, because when he was released as a ward of the state into my care when I was 18 and he came to live with me, it was on a condition that he had to go to the doctor every 2 weeks and have all these psychotic drugs injected. And one of those drugs, it was a cocktail of drugs, and one of them made him basically sterile. It was like a form of chemical castration because he was gay. So the use of psychotropic drugs was certainly incredibly extensive. And, yeah, I sort of saw that happen with my brother and I saw the impacts on him, which were just horrific. Like I had to teach him how to eat, how to drink, how to walk, how to clean his teeth. Those drugs just had a stupefying effect on them, that they became completely dependent on the institution for everything. Did the girls who you interviewed, did they describe the impacts of the drugs having that kind of impact on their life afterwards as well?
Absolutely, because, you know, we talked about, you know, just even basic living skills. You know, as growing up, they had no idea even how to cook a meal or to, you know, manage finances or, you know, just the basic things that, you know, young people transitioning into adulthood learn. They hadn't learned those. You know, their schooling was so virtually non-existent from the time they went there. So they'd missed out on all of that education, you know, formal education, but life education as well. And I meant to say, Kerry, when they started their campaign for redress, there was, I think, 20 of them, and by the time I came to do the interviews, there was 10, that the others had either died of natural causes or had suicided. And they were, you know, of the opinion that this needs to happen before there's none of us left.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And so you talked about with fear and isolation as well. What was the fear they lived with?
Oh, I think the fear was multiple levels of fear, but I think the biggest one was, you know, which really probably marked a lot of their lives, was mistrust, you know, not being able to trust people. And, you know, that included myself, like, who are you? What do you want? You know, were you wanting any of this redress money? All of that. And I'm going, oh, my God, no. But, you know, I would have said it took a while for them to trust me, to be able to know that I'm doing this to try and get the best outcome for them. But I understood that, you know, why would you trust anyone if that's what your life's been like? So they, yeah, that was the biggest thing. And I think trust within, not all, but some of their families, their relationships with other people, you know, I think that kept them isolated a lot.
And did some of them did get access to their medical records? Because they all asked, didn't they?
Yes. Yes, they did, and some did. I'm not sure how many, but, yes, some did, and they got a compensation payment, and they also got some provisions around, you know, expedited healthcare, et cetera.
Okay, so they, it took a very long time for them to get justice, but after you handed your report to, so after you handed your report to Leslie Shombrook, the acting health commissioner, these now women who'd been fighting for justice for many, many, many years, well over a decade, wasn't it? Maybe two decades. They finally got some redress. And what was that?
My report actually went direct to Cameron Dick as health minister.
Okay, sorry.
Because he was the one that commissioned it. Leslie Shombrook at the time was the mental health commissioner. She had been championing the case for these women for a long, long time and, you know, provided excellent background and support to myself in doing this, and I appreciated that. But ultimately it was the Queensland government with Cameron Dick as the health minister who made the decisions around the redress. Or they didn't call it redress. I think it was called compensation to them. While I'm not at liberty to say amounts of money or anything, but it was actually considered of several things. One of them was free legal advice before they signed anything or accepted anything, so that the women were able to, I guess, finally get hold of enough information and support to make some informed decisions for themselves. Other people had been making those decisions for them for such a long time. I thought that was a really good breakthrough that they could do that.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed for this podcast series on Remembering Randall, My Brother. But my brother Randall was 17, made a state ward, and he was sent to Lowson House at Brisbane Hospital when he was 17. And then the day he turned 18, they sent him to Pierce House at Wollstone Park. Very regrettably, a lot of his experiences seemed very similar to the experiences of the Kuna girls. And I'm trying to encourage the young gay men who were sent there at the same time as those girls. And I too do believe that it was also some sort of incredibly sadistic experiment. At that time, homosexuality was a crime in Queensland. And from my recollection, they were using my brother as like a control group and giving him all sorts of drugs of all sorts of kinds as well. So
terrible, just terrible. So, that, you know, and it's something that many of us didn't know about. You know, we knew about Wollstone Park, I guess, but not this shameful behaviour that was going on.
So, Betty, there's also the issue around the thousands of dead bodies, the morgue, the three cemeteries. Very simple. They could have just got the patient records, the patient discharge records, and figured out which ones were never discharged, and then you'd come up with a list of names of those dead. But that's never happened. So
the women talked a lot about they observed children at Woolston Park, and they believed those remains include children. But that's never been disproved or proved.
No, no. I did observe children when I used to visit my brother, and they were very obviously children with intellectual and physical disabilities, and I found that incredibly distressing.
Well, I hope you get some answers, and anything I can do to support, I will, Kerry, because it is a block. It's a huge block on our past here in Queensland, and, you know, we've got to be able to do something better about it. It's shocking.
So do you think there should be a Royal Commission or an inquiry into Woolston Park?
I do. I just don't know if there's enough people that will call for it, but I definitely do. Because okay. So many have deceased and moved on, or they've, you know, because they're wards of the state, you know, the families aren't around to champion for them. You know, it's wonderful that you are, but I don't know how many other family members are out there that would, you know, I just think it's a huge blot on our past.
Thank you so much, Betty, for agreeing to be interviewed for the podcast, Remembering Randall. I'm Kerry Carrington, and you've been listening to the podcast series Remembering Randall.